From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. Today, animal emotions and what they tell us about ourselves. We talk with Franz de Waal, who studies the behavior and emotion of chimps at the Yerkes National Primate Research Center. In his new book, he writes about primate empathy, rivalry, bonding, sharing, jealousy, reconciliation, sex, and murder. He's bonded with some of the chimps he studied, but he recognizes the limitations.
When I was a student and started working with chimps, I dreamed at some point that I would ask the alpha male if I could come in and join them. And he said, no, Franz, this world is much too rough for you. And he was right. It is a pretty tough world.
And Maureen Corrigan reviews a book about the friendship between Zora Neale Hurston and Langston Hughes and their bitter falling out. That's coming up on Fresh Air. First News. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. The animals genetically closest to humans, chimps and bonobos, also express a lot of the same emotions we do, according to my guest Frans de Waal. He's been accused of anthropomorphism, attributing the characteristics of humans to animals. But his research has convinced a lot of skeptics that animals do express emotions similar to ours. He's been studying primate behavior and emotions for 40 years. His primate research is observational and non-invasive. He began his research in the Netherlands, where he was born and grew up. He's now the director of the Living Link Center at the Yerkes National Primate Research Center near Atlanta, where his office window looks out into the colony of chimps whose behavior he studies. He's also a professor at Emory University and a longtime board member of Chimp Haven in Louisiana, the world's largest facility for chimps who are retired from being used for lab research. His new book is called Mama's Last Hug: Animal Emotions and What They Tell Us About Ourselves. Frans de Waal, welcome to Fresh Air. You keep offering evidence that primates have emotions, like humans have emotions. And that might seem obvious to many people now, but it wasn't obvious when you were starting out studying primates. What were you told when you started out about primate emotions?
We were told not to talk about them because they were considered by many scientists as inner states, and you only were allowed to talk about outer states. So you talk about the things that you can see, and emotions they feel are assumptions about feelings and stuff like that. And they and actually thoughts also. So thoughts and feelings, the mental processes basically, were off limits, which is sort of curious because Darwin already talked about the emotions in man and animals. And so Darwin was allowed to talk about it. And then we got this dark period in which we were told, as a student, I was told not to speak about these things.
So the most poignant example of primate emotions that I've ever seen is the video from which your book takes its title, Mama's Last Hug. And this is basically a deathbed visit to a 50-something chimp named Mama, who was the alpha female of the chimp colony at the Burger Zoo, where primates were being studied. And the visitor was your mentor, Jan van Hoof, who was 80. At the time of this visit. Would you describe what happens in this visit?
Well, what happened is that Mama, who was the alpha female and absolutely central figure of the whole colony there, she was dying. And Jan van Hoof, my professor, he decided to enter her night cage, which we normally never do. You never go in with an adult chimpanzee because they're far too dangerous and they're volatile and so on. But since she was dying and since he had known her just like I have known her for 40 years, so was on very good terms with her, but had always visited her with bars in between, he decided to go in. And what's interesting is that apart from the response that she had a big grin on her face, and she embraced him and patted him on the back and things like that, was that she was reassuring him. She must have sensed, and this was typically Mama because she was a very sort of a calming figure in the colony. She must have sensed that Jan van Hoof was nervous and that it was extremely unusual situation, and so she calmed him down. And the thing that struck me is not so much that people were moved by the video, because it was first shown on national TV in Holland and then later on the internet. That people were moved was completely understandable. I was very moved by the whole thing. But that people were surprised how human-like the expression of Mama was and how human-like her gestures were. And that is something that struck me, as I thought, well, everyone knows that chimps are our closest relatives, so why wouldn't the way they express their emotions be extremely similar to ours? But people were surprised by that.
You know, it's really such a beautiful video because he's petting her and she's kind of petting him. She's stroking him. And when he walks in, she has this, like, you know, she's just been lying there expressionless with her eyes open. They look like the eyes of an animal that's dying. But when he walks in, like, I've never seen a chimp smile like that. I mean, like, her whole face changes and her whole mouth just changes. So it really is beautiful. What was the nature of your relationship with Mama?
Oh, I was just as close. I didn't live as close as Jan, but because I live in the U.S., but each time I would show my face at the zoo, even if I was among hundreds of visitors, she would pick me out and she would come over to greet me from across the moat, because they live on an island most of the time. So I had a very close relationship with her, and she was actually not just a diplomat in her own group, because it's a very big chimp colony with 25 individuals and a lot of power struggles and stuff like that, but also she was a diplomat to the outside, to us humans who took care of them at the zoo. And so she maintained relationships with lots of people.
And you write that you had grooming sessions with her. Would you describe what happens in a grooming session between a human like you and a chimp like Mama?
Oh, they love to groom. Actually, you should be careful. If you have a little injury on your hand or your arm, they try to open it, because that's how they clean injuries on each other. And so and she likes to groom very small details, like the whimpers on your eyes and things like that. And so she would love to groom me, and I would groom her a little, and talk to each other and stuff like that. So
tell me more about what the grooming means. Like, what are you doing to her, and what is she doing to you?
Grooming is mainly a social activity, especially for animals at zoos. So in the wild, of course, there are ectoparasites and there are ticks and things like that need to be removed. And so grooming has a major function. It's a very important behavior. But also in the wild, I would say that they do more grooming than is strictly needed for hygiene, because it's a calming activity, both for the one who performs it and the one who receives it. And we have still leftover of that when you go to the barber or the hairstylist, and that's a lot of grooming there. But in the chimps, it's very much a bonding ritual, and so it's used after fights to calm each other down. It's used to negotiate, like you may groom the alpha male to get certain favors from the so grooming is basically a service that you exchange. It's one of the many services that chimps exchange, because they have a lot of let's say a service economy going on among themselves.
So Mama had a roommate. I guess this was at night that they would go into cages. Like, describe the situation. Is that what it was?
Mama had a roommate, which her name was Kuif. And not only would they sleep together in the same cage at night, but in the daytime when they were in the colony with the other 25 chimps, they would also very often be together, because Kuif was basically the right-hand woman for Mama. And so they had a coalition, as we usually call it, and a very politically important one, because the males knew that if they had a fight with Mama, they had a fight with Kuif at the same time. So there was always the males knew that they were always dealing with two females there. And so when I would approach her night cage and try to have an interaction with Mama, Kuif would be there. But in the beginning, Kuif would always try to dominate me and take advantage of the fact that Mama was sitting there, her big supporter, and she would try to hit at me and things like that. Chimps always tried to get the upper hand. Mama didn't do that with me, but her friend tried to do that. And that whole attitude of Kuif changed 100% after I helped Kuif raise children, because Kuif had trouble with lactation. She didn't have enough milk production. And so she lost a few infants, and this was a terribly depressing time for her, and she would be crying and not eating. And she was extremely depressed by losing her infants. And at some point, I decided, since we had a baby chimp up for adoption, I decided to teach her how to bottle feed a baby. And so from that moment on, she adopted an infant that she raised on the bottle, and then she raised her own offspring. In the years after, she raised her own offspring also on the bottle.
How did you teach Kuif how to bottle feed her baby and the adopted baby that you gave her? And the adopted baby was from a female chimp who was deaf and had trouble raising her babies.
Yeah, so that female was deaf, and she had lost also a couple of babies because of her deafness and not responding well to the baby. And so we decided we were not going to have her had babies anymore. And that's why we handed it over to Kuif and taught her how to bottle feed. And the way we did that is that I kept the baby for 6 weeks, I believe, together with the caretaker, female caretaker. We together held that baby. And so for 6 weeks, we held it on our side, and we taught Kuif how to hold the bottle and feed it and to the baby, and that the baby would be suckling and all of that. And Then after 6 weeks, we gave it to her. We put it in the straw of her cage and she would find it there. And the funny thing was that in the beginning, she didn't want to take it. And that is, I think, because she considered it our baby, which is obvious because we had had it for 6 weeks. And in chimps, it's not very well regarded to take the baby of somebody else. And so she was extremely reluctant to even approach it. And she kept looking at us. And we kept saying, well, you go ahead and stuff like that. And at some point she approached the baby and she took it and she never left it from that moment on. So she adopted that baby chimp. And since that time, and I described that in my text as gratitude, I saw that as a sign of gratitude. She was extremely friendly with me. I was basically a family member. She never, ever struck out at me again after that time. And she was very much in favor always when I came and always very sad if I left because I had become part of her family, I think.
So one of the things you learned about this bottle feeding exchange was that chimps are capable of something you would describe as gratitude. What else did you learn from teaching an adult female how to bottle feed a baby?
Well, one of the things we saw was that she was very adept with the bottle because she did a bunch of things that we never had taught her, like watching when the bottle was getting empty or pulling it out if the baby was almost choking on it or needed to burp. And she did a whole bunch of things that we had never taught her. And so she understood how the thing worked. And also she bonded very strongly with that infant, even though she knew it came from us, which basically became her daughter. And is still in the colony and she has offspring of her own also.
And we should explain the colony that Mama and Cuff were part of is a colony of chimps in a zoo in Holland where you've studied them. And
yeah,
it's a colony for study.
Well, I'm from the Netherlands. The colony was founded in a time that all chimps were kept in small cages, in small groups, because the zoos in the world had decided that chimps were to be kept a bit like gorillas, like one male and three females or something like that. Even though in the wild, of course, chimps live in large groups of sometimes 12 males, sometimes even 20 males, adult males. And so when this colony was set up at the time, there was a lot of resistance and a lot of skepticism. People said, well, this is never going to work. If you have so many males together, they're going to fight and they're going to kill each other. And so there was a lot of problems with that. But actually, that colony in Burger Zoo is an example now for many zoo colonies in the world and has been the most successful breeding colony in the world, I think. So it was a great success. And I watched them mainly to study aggressive behavior, because at the time that I was a student, that was the popular topic that everyone should study, is where does aggression come from and what is the aggressive instinct. And in the meantime of studying them, I got interested in actually the opposite of aggression. I got interested in reconciliation. How do chimps make up after fights? I found that more interesting than all the aggression that I saw. And so I got interested in how they kiss and embrace after a fight, how they groom each other, and how they maintain the peace, basically.
Give us an example of something you witnessed showing how chimps reconcile.
Yeah, I think one of the most striking observations was the first one I made when I didn't even expect the phenomenon. I didn't know about it because no one talked about these things. And so at some point, I saw a big fight in the colony between two individuals. And I had recorded all of this. We had the first video recorders of the time, which was a pretty amazing technology at the time. And so I had recorded it. And a couple of hours later, I saw a big commotion in the group and two individuals hugging each other and all the rest of the chimpanzees hooting and yelling and gathering around them. And I did not understand what was going on. I had no clue. And in the evening, I biked back to my home. We do everything on bike in Holland. So I biked back to my home. And thinking about the incident, I thought, well, it's actually the same two individuals who had the fight. So and that's where the word reconciliation popped in my mind. Like, you know, I'm from a very big family. So I'm very used to the mechanism. And so that's why I thought it could be a reconciliation. And from that moment on, I started looking for it. I started, each time there was a fight in the colony, I thought, well, what are they going to do afterwards? And I noticed that half the time, they come together and they kiss and they embrace and they groom each other. And I got really interested in that phenomenon. And I decided to make a study out of that, in the sense that I decided the rest of my career I was going to devote to that kind of mechanisms, the sort of mechanisms that chimps or bonobos or other primates use to maintain the peace, to have a cooperative relationship. Do they have empathy for each other? That sort of phenomena I really got interested in.
Let me reintroduce you here. If you're just joining us, my guest is Frans de Waal. He studies animal behavior. He's the director of the Living Links Center at Yerkes Primate Research Center, which is in and near Atlanta. They have separate facilities. And he also teaches at Emory University. His new book is called Mama's Last Hug, Animal Emotions and What They Tell Us About Ourselves. We'll be right back. This is Fresh Air. This is Fresh Air, and if you're just joining us, my guest is Frans de Waal, who's well known for his research into primate behavior. He has a new book called Mama's Last Hug, Animal Emotions, and What They Tell Us About Ourselves. So in studying animal emotions, you've studied a lot how primates reconcile after fights, but you also study things that are disturbing. Like, you don't back away when you see something that's disturbing. And you now think that chimps are capable of murder, and you don't use the word murder without careful consideration. There was an incident in 1980 which you came to think of as a murder, and I want you to explain what happened and why you thought of it in terms of murder.
Well, what happened, I was studying the power struggles among the adult males in the colony, and there's occasional fights, but they're not too bad usually. But in this case, it completely went out of control because the males were at night in their night cages. And we had tried to separate them the day before. We had done our best to separate them at night because we were worried about the tensions between them. But they didn't want to be separated. They kept clinging to each other. And each time we tried to lower a door, they shuffled in it together. And so at the end of the evening, it was a long evening, we gave up and we decided to let them sleep together and gave them a whole bunch of night cages so that they could move around. But in that night, one of the males, the leading male, he got basically killed. Well, in the next morning, I found him bleeding and near death, and he died later in the day. And so what happened is that the two other males had ganged up on him, and they had barely scratches. So they had very well coordinated. And at the time, I must say, I was disturbed because I thought maybe this is an effect of captivity and this would normally never have happened. But now we know actually, and I've described many cases, we know many of them in the wild as well. So in the wild, chimpanzees, they do kill between groups. So males who are strangers to each other, that's a fairly common occurrence. But also on occasion, the way it happened at the Arnhem colony, on occasion they do it within the group. And so these are political struggles where they really go to the extreme. And the unfortunate thing of that whole incident is that if the females had been there, the females would have stopped the thing, I'm sure.
How would they have stopped it?
Well, the females would have jumped in and beaten them apart. So if you have in a captive colony, the females are more powerful actually than in the wild, because in the wild the females are dispersed over the forest usually. But in a colony on an island like in Arnhem, you have 12 females and they band together and they're extremely coordinated. And if Mama, the alpha female, decides that fight is not worth it, she's going to jump in and kick them apart.
So you described the two chimps murdering the alpha chimp. But it was a very brutal murder, and it sounded like there was almost like sadism involved with it. So maybe sadism isn't the right word, but I want you to describe more about how brutal this was.
This is very similar to what in the wild they have also seen, is that it seems intentional, and the descriptions of chimps in the wild are very often when they kill each other, that multiple males gang together, and it seems that they intentionally bring down the other. And in our case, these two males, they had mutilated that one male terribly, and they had even castrated him, and they had caused so many injuries that in the end he died of blood loss. We couldn't replace that. And so it was absolutely brutal, yeah.
My guest is Frans de Waal. His new book is called Mama's Last Hug, Animal Emotions and What They Tell Us About Ourselves. After we take a short break, he'll tell us how female bonobos assert and maintain power. And also, Maureen Corrigan will review a new book about the friendship and then the falling out between Langston Hughes and Zora Neale Hurston. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
The Neubauer Family Foundation supports WHYY's Fresh Air and its commitment to sharing ideas and encouraging meaningful conversation. Support for NPR comes from this station and from Amazon Web Services, whether it's searching for life on other planets or helping enterprises reinvent their industries. AWS works to help technology scale to meet the challenge. More at awsishow.com. And from Home Advisor, matching homeowners with home improvement professionals for a variety of home projects, from minor repairs to major remodels. Homeowners can read reviews of local pros and book appointments online at homeadvisor.com.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Let's get back to my interview with Frans de Waal. He's been studying primate behavior and emotions for 40 years. He began his research in the Netherlands, where he was born and grew up. He's now the director of the Living Links Center at Yerkes National Primate Research Center near Atlanta and is a professor at Emory University. He's also a longtime board member of Chimp Haven in Louisiana, which is the world's largest facility for chimps who are retired from being used for lab research. His new book is called Mama's Last Hug, Animal Emotions and What They Tell Us About Ourselves. You popularized the term alpha male when using it to describe primate behavior. And what did you mean when you started using it?
Well, alpha male in my field just means the top male. You have the top male and the top female. You have only one of them. You cannot have two alpha males in a group of chimps or two alpha females. So it means the top individual. And the term comes out of wolf research. The wolf researchers, they use that term also just for the top male or the top female.
And you say sharing is a very important part of getting and maintaining alpha male power.
Yeah, the alpha male has many duties, I think, also. And an alpha male who keeps the peace in the group, a good alpha male breaks up fights and defends the underdog, not usually the winners, but the losers. And the alpha male also is the consoler-in-chief, goes to individuals after a fight to console the ones who have lost and sit with them and groom with them and hold them and things like that. And so the consoler-in-chief role is extremely important. And an alpha male who is good at that, he is also usually kept in power for longer. So in a chimpanzee society, you always have challengers to the top male. And it's almost as if the group is waiting. If the male is a bully that they don't like, they're almost waiting for that challenger and they're going to put their weight behind him. And if it's a good alpha male who keeps order and is protective and is not abusive, then they try to keep that male in power.
Let's talk about female power in the primate world. You've told us a little bit about female chimps and through the story of Mama. But bonobos in the wild, the alpha females are especially powerful. And you say it's usually a female that's in charge of the bonobo colony. How do female bonobos get and assert their power?
Yeah, so the bonobo is interesting that we have two close relatives, the chimpanzee and the bonobo. They're equally close to us, genetically exactly equally close. And so they're equally relevant, in my opinion, even though many anthropologists have preferred the chimpanzee. The chimpanzee is male-dominated, quite aggressive, has war going on between groups, basically, because they kill between groups. And the anthropologists have flocked to the chimpanzee and have ignored the bonobo because the bonobo is very sexy and peaceful and female-dominated, and they just don't know what to do with that. I don't know a single colony of bonobos in captivity that is not led by a female. And in the wild, we now know that most of the time also at the top of the hierarchy is females more than males. So the bonobo is a very female-dominated society. If you ask, how do these females get to the top? That's an interesting problem. I think in female chimps, like with Mama, or in female bonobos, age and personality are the main factors. And so there's actually very little open competition and politics going on the way it is among the males. It is if you wait long enough and you get old enough and you have a strong personality, you can be the alpha. In both bonobos and chimps, I very rarely see a sort of middle-aged female dominating these older females. If you have a group, let's say, with a few 25-year-old females and a few 40-year-old females, and the 40-year-olds really are physically not as strong as the 25-year-olds, I can tell you, it's going to be the 40-year-old females who are at the top. That's a very different situation from the males. In the males, if you get too old, you get weaker, and you're going to be kicked out of the top position.
I don't know if certain female chimps and certain female bonobos are perceived as being like more sexually attractive than others, but is there any correlation between like sex and power, or reproductive years and power?
In humans and in all species, this is very typical. Is that a male? And this is universal. A male can increase his reproductive success, which is the driver of evolution. A male can increase it by mating with lots of partners. So a male chimpanzee who mates with 20 females, he can, in principle, have 20 babies. A female chimpanzee who mates with 20 males doesn't make any difference. She still gets one baby. And that's why the rules for males and females in reproduction are totally different. And the power structure reflects that, is that males, often they try to reach the top position, and that gives them mating privileges. For the females, I don't think that's the issue. It's mating privileges are not the issue. For female primates in general, what is the issue is food. They, in order to raise offsprings and to be successful at that, you need to gather enough food. And so there is competition among females. And in many primates, we find very intense competition among females, but it's usually about food. It's not about sex.
So another thing about primates, and I think this is true of all primates. You can correct me on this, but like they can mate, like, and the female can have a child, but they don't form couple relationships. You know, the father doesn't become the father and the mother don't become a pair. So does the father take no responsibility for the baby?
I consider that actually the biggest difference between us humans and the two apes who are closest to us, chimps and bonobos. I know people always like to emphasize our intellectual capacities and language and stuff like that, but actually the fact that we form families, stable families with male-female offspring, is drastically different from what we see in the other apes. So in some of the primates, there are males involved in offspring care, but in our closest relatives, that's not the rule. And so a chimp male or a bonobo male, they do extremely little. And that's also why it all comes down to the female, and that's why the females have these very long interbirth intervals. And that means that a female bonobo or a female chimp, they get a baby about every 6 years. They cannot do more because at some point they shift their baby from the belly to the back, and at that point there's a place open at the belly, but they have to travel through the forest, through the trees, with these offspring clinging to them. And so they cannot have two offspring, is just too many for them. And so that's why they have a long interbirth interval. And we have a shortened one. We can have one of 2 years. And that's all because males are involved in offspring care. So we have cooperative breeding, so females help each other. That's also very important. But on top of that, we have males being involved. And the human male actually is more inclined and more motivated and has hormonal changes when he has an offspring. So the human male is sort of predestined to be at least a little bit or sometimes a lot being involved in offspring care.
Okay, so we're going to take a short break and then we'll talk some more. If you're just joining us, my guest is Frans de Waal, who studies animal behavior in primates. And he's especially interested in emotions in animal behavior, and that's what his new book is about. It's called Mama's Last Hug, Animal Emotions and What They Tell Us About Ourselves. We'll be right back after this break. This is Fresh Air.
Support for NPR comes from this station and from Tire Rack, offering a tire decision guide to help customers find tires that fit their car and driving conditions. With a network of more than 7,000 independent installers, TireRack.com, helping drivers find, deliver, install. And from Amazon Web Services, working to help millions of customers, from startups to enterprises to governments, transform their industries with secure, AI-ready cloud services. Learn more at awsishow.com.
This is Fresh Air, and if you're just joining us, my guest is Frans de Waal, who studies animal behavior. He's the director of the Living Lynx Center at Yerkes Primate Research Center, which is located in and around Atlanta. He's a professor at Emory University and author of several books, including the new one, Mama's Last Hug, Animal Emotions and What They Tell Us About Ourselves. So here's an interesting experiment that you conducted that I want you to tell us about, and it involves two capuchins, small primates, and it involves grapes and cucumbers. Tell us about the experiment and what you were trying to show.
I've always had a capuchin monkey colony, and the capuchin monkeys, they lived in groups, and then sometimes we would take two of them out and bring them in a test chamber and test them out on food sharing or cooperation or whatever it was. And we always noticed during these experiments that the monkeys were very much watching what the other one was getting. So instead of just caring about their own rewards, which you would expect them to do, like how much did I work and what do I get for it, they were watching what the neighbor was getting. And so with Sarah Brosnan, I decided we're going to test this out. We're going to compare a very simple task. We give them different rewards for the same task. And so the task was very simple. We throw a little rock in their test chamber, and they have to hand it back to us. And if you both give both monkeys pieces of cucumber, they're perfectly fine, and they will do it 25 times in a row without any problems. If you give both of them grapes, and grapes are 10 times better than cucumber, they also perform 25 times without problems. The trouble starts when you feed one monkey grapes and the other one cucumber. Now, the one who is shortchanged, because cucumber is not as good, then starts to refuse and actually becomes agitated and may throw the cucumber out or may at least stop performing and sit in the corner and not give anything about the test anymore, which is very strange because the food is normally good. And any time you give a piece of cucumber to one of these monkeys, they will eat it. But under these circumstances, they don't. So they get a sort of pissed off at the whole situation. And so I got interested in that, and it's an inequity response. It has to do with fairness. We started testing it out then later in chimpanzees, which have a sense of fairness that gets much closer to ours. But in the monkeys already, it works that way. And people have tested actually also dogs that way. They can perform a very simple task, and they get unequally rewarded. And dogs, you can do that experiment at home, basically, if you have two dogs. Dogs are sensitive to this too.
Yeah, and I should say with the Capuchin monkeys, there's a video of this that you've used mm-hmm. in your talks. And I've seen it, and like the Capuchin monkey that's getting shortchanged and is getting the cucumber while the monkey in the cell next to him is getting the grapes. The cucumber guy starts getting like so upset, he's like basically throwing the cucumber at the person who's feeding it to him and then like mm-hmm. rattling the cage and like pounding the mm-hmm. wall of the cage. I mean, he's really angry. And so, like, you've compared this to, like, political inequity and why people who know that other people are getting more and who therefore feel like they're being treated unfairly, this sense of, like, you have more anger when you see injustice than you, like, if you don't have something and you just don't have it, it's not as bad as not having something and realizing that other people have it and there's some kind of inequity in the system where others are getting yeah. things that you're not.
Yeah, so it's essentially an envy response. If you talk about emotions, the emotion behind it is envy or jealousy by the monkey who gets less than the other. And so that's a very early response. And I think what we do in the human sense of fairness is we try to equalize outcomes in order to avoid these envy responses, which are negative and destructive. And so when you test chimpanzees, who are much more like us, we did an experiment with chimpanzees and children, actually, and the children and the chimps had the same responses. In chimpanzees, they try to equalize the outcome. So if you give a grape and cucumber to two chimpanzees, the one who gets the grape may refuse the grape till the other one also gets a grape. And so they try to equalize outcomes, which is very well known of small human societies, is that they are very egalitarian and they have a very strong sense of fairness because unfairness undermines the society. And that's, of course, the problem that we face in our current societies, which are largely anonymous and are so huge that people can get away with these inequities and people can get away by being the 1% grape eaters, so to speak. So people get away with these things and it's undermining the fabric of the society. So inequity is, in my opinion, not good for societies. And even chimpanzees know that and they will try to share equally. Just as small-scale human societies do.
Students who study animal behavior were always warned about anthropomorphism, which is when you attribute human characteristics to animals. Like saying, oh, he's so happy, or look, he's so sad. But you say that equally or perhaps even more dangerous is anthropodenialism. So compare the two for us, anthropomorphism and anthropodenialism.
So anthropomorphism is a term often slung at us when we propose that your dog is jealous or that chimpanzees may be attached to each other or when you use human-like terminology or they reconcile after fights. I was told actually for reconciliation to use post-conflict mouth-to-mouth contact because they kiss each other after fights. So they didn't want me to use the word reconciliation because it sounds too human-like. And I think for species that are close to us, like the primates, anthropomorphism is really not a big problem because we are primates and so we should use the same terminology. We don't call the hand of a chimpanzee a front paw. No, we call it a hand because it is the same form, the same structure, the same bones as our hand. And so we should use the same terminology for structures that are similar, but also for behaviors that are similar. And if you, let's say, you tickle a chimpanzee and they produce laughing sounds, like type laughing sounds, you have to call it laughing. It is laughing. It is not vocalized panting, as people would want me to say. So I think anthropomorphism is not such a big deal with species that are close to us. And that's why I invented the word anthropodenial, which is the opposite, is that you deny that there are connections between humans and other species. And actually, entire areas in the university, like philosophy, anthropology, parts of psychology, they are in anthropodenial. They live in a way, they think that the human mind and the human spirit are so totally different, we cannot compare them with what a monkey or a dolphin or which other animal is doing. And so they are denying that connection, which I think is detrimental and is actually much more dangerous in my opinion, because anthropodenial has a lot of negative side effects in my mind. It's much more dangerous than anthropomorphism.
What are some of the other side effects?
Well, one of them is we live at the moment in a time where we're destroying the planet. We humans are an ecological disaster. And entire species and large numbers of animals are disappearing. Forests is disappearing. The globe is warming. And that is all a result, I think, of our attitude, is that we can do whatever we want with nature because we're not really part of nature. We're sort of outside nature. And since we're outside, we can do whatever we want. And I think that attitude is also reflected in how we look at other animals. And I think it's a very dangerous attitude not to think that we are part of it and we have to act responsibly within that framework.
So your new book is all about, you know, primates, chimps, bonobos, uh-huh, capuchin monkeys, and how they express emotion. When you started doing this work, it was very controversial. Like, do primates really express emotion? And that's been controversial, I think, in a lot of animal research. Do you think that we should not be debating anymore whether animals have emotions? We should just accept that they do?
Well, I even take a more radical position, of course, in the book, is that I think we have no uniquely human emotions. There are no emotions that we have that you don't find one way or another. There may be variations that we have or different circumstances in which we feel these emotions, but I think all human emotions can be found in other species. And we live at the moment in psychology with the most popular theory in psychology is that there are only six basic emotions. There are six emotions that we, like anger and fear, that we humans express in the face and that we recognize in the face all over the world and is expressed the same way all over the world. There are six basic emotions, and all the other emotions are secondary, meaning that they are a creation of our culture and ourselves, and they're not found necessarily in other species. And I disagree strongly with that. For example, the secondary emotions include something like love and attachment. Now, love and attachment we find in so many species. We know actually the dopamine system that's behind it. We know the oxytocin that's behind it. And so why is love and attachment not a basic emotion? So I think there's many emotions that don't have a face, that don't have a specific face, that are nevertheless found in lots of other species. And I am now at the point that I think emotions are more like organs. I don't have a single organ in my body that you don't find in a rat body. We have livers and kidneys and hearts and brains and lungs, and all my organs are present in a rat body. And in the same way, I think all my emotions are probably present in the rat.
Franz de Waal, thank you so much for talking with us.
You're welcome.
Franz de Waal is the author of the new book, Mama's Last Hug, Animal Emotions and What They Tell Us About Ourselves. After we take a short break, Maureen Corrigan will review a new book about the friendship between Zora Neale Hurston and Langston Hughes and their eventual falling out. This is Fresh Air. This is Fresh Air. Yuval Taylor's new book is a biography of a great friendship and its demise. Our book critic Maureen Corrigan says the title pretty much tells you what you need to know. Here's her review of Zora and Langston.
One of the most joyous, true life, on the road adventures in literary history took place in the summer of 1927. It began in Mobile, Alabama, when a young Langston Hughes, who was traveling in the South, stepped off the train from New Orleans and ran smack into Zora Neale Hurston. The two writers had first met in 1925 in Harlem. On the spur of the moment, Zora invited Langston to accompany her on a folklore gathering expedition. Langston hopped into Zora's little two-seater Nash coupe, which she'd nicknamed Sassy Susie, and off they went, driving through big cities like Montgomery and Savannah, and on dirt roads into the countryside. They stopped at Tuskegee, where Langston visited the renowned scientist George Washington Carver, and raced to Macon in time to see Bessie Smith perform. Throughout those weeks on the road, they became best friends, sharing food, money, and conversations about art and race. Oh, to have been a passenger, squeezed into the rumble seat of that little car. Reading Yuval Taylor's new book, Zora and Langston, may be the next best experience. Writing in a vivid anecdotal style, Taylor's book carries readers along on the giddy and ultimately very bumpy ride that was Zora and Langston's friendship. It was a friendship that crashed in 1931 when it ran up against the daunting obstacles of jealousy and self-preservation. Taylor, whose other books include three volumes of African-American slave narratives, has dug up previously unpublished papers and interviews and keeps his focus here tight to help readers grasp the unusual character of this famous literary friendship. Zora and Langston weren't childhood friends like Harper Lee and Truman Capote, nor did theirs start out as a mentor-mentee relationship like that of Fitzgerald and Hemingway, who also met in 1925. And their bond doesn't seem to have been sexual, at least not for Langston. Instead, for a time, they were simply each other's person. As Zora confessed in a 1931 letter to Langston, "You are the nearest person on earth to me." Langston's response has been lost, as have most of his letters to Zora, but the evidence of their daily lives together in 1920s New York, where they were comrades in art, struggle, and merriment, speaks volumes, as do Langston's poems. Taylor quotes a line from one of those poems, Harlem Night Song, written the year after he met Zora. It describes two people who roam the night together, singing, "I love you." The world of Roaring Twenties New York, and particularly the man-made wonder that was the Harlem Renaissance, has been chronicled many a time before. But reading about that era never gets old, at least not to me. Taylor dives in with gusto, describing the delights of 1920s Harlem, the mansions on Stryver's Row, and the octoroon choruses at the Lafayette Theater. His book opens with Langston's and Zora's first meeting in May 1925 at the ornate Fifth Avenue restaurant, where a glittering and interracial crowd, including County Cullen, Paul Robeson, and Eugene O'Neill, gathered over a dinner of boiled chicken and concealed gin flasks for an award ceremony sponsored by the National Urban League's magazine, Opportunity. Zora and Langston were the Young Turks, artists who, as Taylor describes, celebrated the everyday words and rhythms of African Americans, a then controversial strategy that would shape the future direction of African American literature. Another thing they shared was poverty. Langston famously worked as a busboy. Zora developed a lifelong voracious appetite, explaining to the novelist Fanny Hurst that, "I was hungry for so many years of my life. I get going nowadays and can't stop. The fear of falling into destitution led both of them into the arms of Charlotte Osgood Mason, the eccentric and controlling Park Avenue white philanthropist who insisted that both of them call her Godmother. Mason ardently supported what was then called the New Negro Renaissance, believing that Black folk were less tainted by civilization. She told Langston, for instance, that he was a golden star in the firmament of primitive peoples. It was Mason's eventual rift with Langston, along with Zora and Langston's argument over the rights to their collaborative play Mulebone, that Taylor says contributed to the devastating breakup of their relationship. For the last 30 years of their lives, the two were painfully estranged. But let's not go there. Let's focus, as Taylor so evocatively does, on the blossoming of the great friendship between an aspiring Zora and Langston, on the wide road opening up before them, and on the gifts they shared with each other and with us.
Maureen Corrigan teaches literature at Georgetown University. Tomorrow on Fresh Air, my guest will be Heidi Schreck. She wrote and performs the show What the Constitution Means to Me. It's about when she was a teenager debating the Constitution in competitions sponsored by the American Legion, and her later realization that the Constitution failed to protect four generations of women in her family. I'm Terry Gross.
Support for NPR comes from this station and from Subaru. Learn more at Subaru.com.